The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
We need international help to rebuild Kharkiv. We need international help at all because of we want to NATO to close the sky. We need more weapon and jets maybe, but we also need help to rebuild our cities, our economy, because now, you know, Mariupol on the southern part of Ukraine, it's completely ruined. It was a prosperous city, and now it's like ghost city.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 11th, 2022. Dmytro Kosobov is the editor-in-chief of Lyuk Media in Kharkiv, Ukraine. It is a publication that used to be devoted to the culture and people and underground life of the country's second largest city. Then came the war. As men are not allowed to leave the country, Dmytro is camped out about 10 kilometers from the center of Kharkiv, but that did not stop him from joining me in the virtual jungle studio to talk about his work as a Ukrainian cultural journalist before the war and how everything has changed during the war in a Russian-speaking city that has become very Ukrainian. Some of this discussion takes place in English and some takes place in Russian. Simultaneous translation of those parts are done by Dominic Bustillos. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 11th, Dmytro Kosobov on doing journalism in Kharkiv during the war. So why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself? Who were you before the war?
Yeah, okay. My name is Dmytro. I was born in Kharkiv, and I'm 33 years old now, and all my life I've been living in Kharkiv. It's my native city. I'm working as a journalist for the last 8 years, and for the last 2 years I have been the editor-in-chief of Lyuk Media. It's Kharkiv media about local culture, about some underground artists, projects, and so on. So we made this to promote Kharkiv, to promote our city, because there's some problem that a lot of people are going to Kyiv, to the capital of Ukraine, because there are more opportunities in Kyiv, more vacancies, more money, and so on. And a lot of students, after graduation, go to Kyiv, and we try just to show beauty of our city, to show all these projects, and to motivate people to stay in Kharkiv.
And we hear a lot in the West about, you know, Kharkiv as a, you know, Russian-speaking city. How do you understand Kharkiv, you know, In its ethnic makeup? Do you think of it as, you know, Eastern Ukraine, Russian-oriented Ukraine, or do you think of it as regular part of Ukraine but speaks Russian?
Yes, Kharkiv is a Russian-speaking city mostly. It's about 90% of people who speak Russian, But you know, all these language problems, we don't have such problems. It's political questions, and before every election, politicians start to tell about this language problem, but we don't have language problem. We can speak any language as we want, Russian, Ukrainian, English, it doesn't matter. And now when Putin said that he want to save Russian-speaking people, just more people start speaking Ukrainian now, even my friends, because it's like a protest. I think language is not a problem at all. And Kharkiv is a Ukrainian city, and in 8 years ago, the administrative buildings were occupied by pro-Russian forces, and they were Ukrainian securities set them free, and we don't want such a scenario now, and Kharkiv is a Ukrainian-orientated city, and it's getting more and more patriotic, because everybody now see what happened and what does Russian world mean when rockets and missiles are bombing residential areas. So everybody knows what does it mean now, and the price of this peacemaking operation, as Putin called it.
Where are you now? I assume you're not in Kharkiv.
I'm 10 kilometers from Kharkiv. It's Poltava region. It's the next one to Kharkiv region. And it's quite safe here, but we can say that it's completely safe, because there are no places in Ukraine now where you can feel completely safe. Because they are, for example, they're striking western part, like Lviv and Ivano-Frankivsk, and it's about 10 kilometers from Poland, from NATO borders. So you can't feel safe anywhere in Ukraine now. You know, men from 18 to 60 are prohibited to leave Ukraine now. So just women and children can go abroad.
So tell me about what happened to you starting at the beginning of the conflict. You were a working journalist on cultural matters, and then the war started. Tell me your story.
Actually, I felt like the war would start because of all these articles in Western media, all this information from American intelligence. So I thought that the war would start, and I was ready that it would start. But I tried to live my normal life as all my friends, but it was some like tension in the air because of all these articles and all this information. And just a day before the war, we went to the bar with my friends, and we were joking like it's our last evening in the bar. But actually, it's our last evening in the bar, because I went home about 1 a.m. and just a few hours, then the war started.
Okay, so let me ask you about that. It was the American intelligence announcements and, you know, the Biden statements saying the war was coming. A lot of people, from President Macron to President Zelensky, didn't seem to believe them, or at least made a point of holding out the possibility of them being wrong. But you said you believed it and you were ready for it as a result. I'm curious whether most people you know reacted the way you did, or most people were surprised by the war and didn't expect it?
You know, it depends on people, because we were discussing it with my best friend, and he always told me, don't worry, it'll be okay. And I told that the war will start. So, but I think that our authorities, they just try to calm down people, because if now they say that they were ready for this war, and all this announcement by Zelensky and our authorities that on May we can go to have some rest and to live our peaceful life, maybe it was just чтобы избежать паники.
In order to avoid panic, so that the population wouldn't succumb to panic and the economy would remain more or less stable.
You can say all those things and still be fully prepared, or you can say those things, you know, and kind of, you know, not prepare. Do you feel like the Ukrainian authorities were saying those things but preparing on the other hand, or do you feel like Ukraine should have been more prepared for the war when it happened?
I think that the main thing here is that the war actually has started 8 years ago when Russia occupied Crimea and parts of eastern Ukraine, Donetsk and Luhansk regions. So the war started 8 years ago, and the one thing is that our military was ready for such invasion, and they have good military experience for these 8 years. So actually, I think our authority and military were ready, but our society, I don't know, it depends on every person. Nobody knows how big this war can be. Maybe somebody thought that Russia will hit just military objects, but now they are hitting residential areas where a lot of civilians live. For example, Saltivka is the biggest residential area, and it's about 500,000 people live there. And now it's one of the most destroyed areas in Kharkiv. And there are no military objects at all in this area, just residential houses, buildings.
So let's go back to your story. You were in, you were at the bar, you go home,
yeah,
and a few hours later, the war starts. Were you asleep when it happened? What was your experience that early morning?
Yeah, I was asleep, but a friend of mine, whom I know for 20 years, called me. And when I saw this call, I understood at once that the war began, even before I pick up the phone. So actually, some people heard explosions at about 5 a.m., but I was sleeping. Then I woke up and tried to do normal things, like I made tea, went to the shower, and I already have my emergency bag, because a lot of us started to pack it maybe a month before the war started.
So did you then leave to where you are now, or where did you go?
I called my friends, called my parents, and my father picked me up. I went to my parents' apartment, and then we go to the next basement. It was under a residential building, and it was quite cozy. So we just been there for about 6 hours, and then moved to another basement. It was like a kitchen, and it was very strange, and I slept on the table, and was very scary because it was my first night in the basement, and I really was afraid that something would happen, like bombing or so on. So, and then we moved to my parents' friend's house. It's a private house with quite nice basement. And we've spent there about 6 days and nights. And then we moved to Poltava region. And now we're here for 2.5 weeks.
So in that time, how have you been spending your time? You're a journalist, a cultural journalist, but you're a journalist in a war zone. What are you doing with your days?
Oh, can I speak Russian a little bit?
Of course.
We tried to reformat our publication. That is, now we primarily write about the war and about everything connected to it. We interview people who have suffered from the war in some way. We give some recommendations to people on evacuation or enlisting in the territorial defense forces. And I manage a chronicle of the war, a war diary. And I also manage a war diary in which each day I describe what is happening in Ukraine and I describe my feelings and reflections regarding what is happening.
And how many of you are there?
There are about four of us in our team. And my colleagues now are in Chernivtsi, in western part of Ukraine. It's near the border with Romania. But we're working online. We're used to it because actually it's, with the pandemic, we just become more...
more flexible in this regard, and we can work remotely.
And so you were interested in, you got into this business because you were interested in telling a Kharkiv story and making it more attractive for young people who, so that they wouldn't go to Kyiv. And now you have the world's attention on Kharkiv, but for all the wrong reasons. I'm curious, what is the story that you want the world to understand about your city now? You're not talking to its residents, you're talking to the rest of the world. What should people be understanding about Kharkiv?
Yeah, I always wanted to the world, just to know about Kharkiv, but of course not under such circumstances. But I think even now it's good when people know about Kharkiv, because actually it's a beautiful city. It's the second city of Ukraine, and it's about 1.5 million people. So it's I think it's like Prague. Kharkiv is a very interesting, developing, prosperous city with a lot of culture and historical heritage, with a lot of interesting people projects. So it's very pity that things are going like this, because, for example, now a lot of our historical buildings are destroyed, even those one who resist during the World War II. For some historical monuments, they Russians are destroying them now.
Yeah, so let's talk about the damage. You know, from the images that we see in Western media, it looks like the damage has been just massive. From your perspective, what do we know about the extent of the damage in the city, and also about the, you know, the casualties among civilians?
Yes, the damage is very big, because they are bombing chaotically residential areas, schools, hospitals, kindergartens, even cathedrals. So now there are almost thousands of buildings that are destroyed, and including almost 800 of residential buildings.
And when you say residential buildings, do you mean apartment buildings mostly, or how individual houses?
More apartment buildings, because, for example, this Saltivka area, which I was taught about, it's like big apartment buildings which were built on the 70s of the last century. And these buildings are very similar to each other, and a lot of people live there.
So when you say 800 residential buildings, on average, how many people are living in each one?
It's really hard to talk, but our city authorities told that about
250,000. They have remained without roofs over their heads and without housing at the moment.
So it's, if the war ended today and there were no more shelling in Kharkiv, you're talking about a major, major rebuilding project at this point, yeah?
Yeah, of course. We're ready to rebuild our city, and I think, I hope that a lot of people will come back and try to rebuild our city. Because, for example, a lot of my friends are on western part of Ukraine, but all of them want to return to Kharkiv, and me too. I want to return as soon as possible, but now it's really very dangerous. That's why I had to leave, but it's my favorite city. I always told to anybody that Kharkiv is the best city for living in Ukraine, and we promote it in our project. And of course, I try to return to Kharkiv as soon as possible, and we will rebuild it.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
But the amount of work to rebuild those buildings is, I mean, 800 buildings with 2,500 people living in them each, that's a lot of people without homes.
Yeah, sure, but we need international help to rebuild Kharkiv. We need international help at all because of we want to not to close the sky. We need more weapon and jets maybe, but we also need help to rebuild our cities, our economy, because now, you know, Mariupol on the southern part of Ukraine, it's completely ruined. It was a prosperous city, and now it's like ghost city. They keep on bombing all the cities in the east of Ukraine, in the south of Ukraine, in the north of Ukraine. So it's like a war against my country. It's a genocide of Ukrainian nation. Such things are going in the center of Europe in the 21st century. So like bombing of schools, hospitals, and it's catastrophe.
So you work as in normal times, you're cultural journalist about Kharkiv. How bad has the damage been to the cultural heritage of the city as opposed to the residential buildings?
There are a lot of culture objects which were damaged. For example, Opera House, Kharkiv Art Museum, Uspensky Cathedral, and Philharmonic. So these objects are destroyed now. Not just they have some damage. They not just destroyed completely, but they were damaged. And Kharkiv National University, for example, it's the oldest university in the city and one of the biggest in the country and in central and in the Eastern Europe. It's some buildings of this university are also damaged. They tried to strike to the police office and they hit the university. And of course, it's problem. For example, the bar where I was just before the war, on the evening before the war, it's also destroyed, this building. And it's architectural monument. It was built in 1911, so it's more than 100 years, and this building is completely destroyed. And Kharkiv is quite different in the context of architecture. And a lot of buildings which are more than 100 years, so it's a period of Russian Empire before October Revolution, so they are now damaged or destroyed.
And do you have a sense of, like, why the Russians are destroying a bar room? It's not... Do you think it was intentionally targeted, or do you think they were just shooting shells in indiscriminately and it got hit? Why the Opera House? Why the Philharmonic Hall?
I think that firstly they tried to capture our cities by ground forces, but then when they couldn't do it, they just started to bomb everything. It's not a military operation, it's just chaotically bombing of our cities. So, for example, this Opera House, it's very nice. It's like brutalism architecture style, and it looks like a big spaceship. And all my friends from different countries, when they came to Kharkiv, they said that this opera house looks like some space object because it's quite interesting architectural style. And Kharkiv is really has very different styles. So like Soviet Kharkiv, like Imperial Kharkiv, and so it's like eclectic city. Why did they hit Opera House? I really don't know. And I don't understand how all these military people выполняют такие приказы.
Carry out such orders.
So tell me about the fighting in Kharkiv now. We were at the beginning of the war. It was sort of one of the centers of the fighting, and now we're hearing much more about Mariupol and the south. Is the fighting still active in Kharkiv, or has it quieted down at this point?
Yeah, it's still active, and they keep on bombing residential areas. For example, the day before yesterday, 8 people died in a residential area on the outskirts of Kharkiv, including a 9-year-old boy. So they were killed. It was the day before yesterday. And now they keep on bombing. I called to Kharkiv in the morning, and it was a really noisy night. And постоянно звучит команда воздушная тревога.
The air raid siren was sounding as usual.
For example, my grandparents, they still stayed in Kharkiv, and one rocket felt maybe half kilometer from the apartment a few days ago, and it was very loud for them, and they can't sleep, and it's horrible things. Maybe there are сейчас меньшее количество.
Right now, there are fewer airstrikes according to the leadership of our oblast, but they continue to bombard the city with multiple rocket launchers.
I'm interested why you have not been required to be part of the territorial defense forces. Are you aged out of that, or why have you not been drafted into territorial defense?
At the moment, they are mobilizing people, first and foremost, who have some kind of combat experience. I am not included in this wave, first of all. Second of all, I think that right now, everyone should do what they do best, and so I'm trying to work in the information space. For instance, I gave an interview to the New York Times and talked about Kharkiv. That is, I try to be useful by doing what I can in the information component.
And so, yeah, let's go back to that question of how you're spending your time. What does work in the information sphere mean for you right now? Like, you're running your publication. What are you focusing on in that work? And who is the audience for it?
About our online project or at all?
I mean, particularly the online project. It's obviously you're not focused on sort of underground culture in Kharkiv right now. What sort of issues are you covering in the course of doing that?
Well, for instance, today we released an interview with the commander of the Kharkiv branch of the Territorial Defense Forces. Earlier, we wrote about a volunteer project which deals with evacuation and helps get people out of Kharkiv to safer places. Moreover, for instance, we are now publishing the letters of people who were forced to leave Kharkiv and who have a lot of emotions concerning their departure. And we are publishing the letters of Kharkiv residents who are now located in different cities.
One difficulty of running an online publication in a war zone, of course, is that many people, presumably in Kharkiv, don't have internet access right now. Has it been a problem to reach your audience, or are people able to, you know, using their phones, access the material that you're publishing?
I think the situation in Kharkiv with network is better than, for example, in Mariupol, because actually there are a lot of
humanitarian aid in Kharkiv. There are many organizations which help people. In terms of internet access, I don't think that people have major problems right now. That is, problems are essentially connected with unpredictability, with how people live in a constant state of tension and how they don't know where new missiles will impact.
So, is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't thought of asking yet?
I just wanted to add that everybody in Ukraine believes that Ukraine will win this war. Of course, we pay a very high price for this, but I am sure that Ukraine will win and we will be a peaceful, developing and prosperous country with beautiful people, and will be a part of European Union, and I think that in 8 years ago, when Maidan happened, we chose our way to Europe, and we don't want to live in such country as Russia. We are very different. We are not brothers with Russia, and now more than 70% of Russian, they just supports this war due to the statistics. So it's not Putin's war, it's war of Russian's nation, of Russian people against my country, against our cities, civilians, schools, kindergartens. And when Western politicians like Chancellor of Germany tell that it's just Putin war, it's not Putin's war. Because only in Mariupol there are more than 20,000 of dead, and they keep on bombing it. It's like a very big tragedy, and we hope that everybody in Europe and in the world will understand that it's a great catastrophe, and we need help of a global community now, because nobody knows what happened next if Putin will occupy Ukraine. We remember World War II, and there are a lot of things that are very similar now in Russian strategy against Ukraine. So we just need help. We just want NATO to close the sky, and we will hope that this war will end as soon as possible.
So I want to ask you about that. Ukraine has gotten a lot of help from NATO and NATO countries, but not the no-fly zone, not certain jets. Are people frustrated with NATO, with Europe, with the United States, or how are people feeling about the Western help that they have and have not gotten?
People are quite disappointed because a lot of people think, and me too, that it's not our war, it's the war between Russia and the whole civilizованный мир.
Civilized world.
And
Putin, as always, lives under the impression that empires rule the world, as if right now it was 1922 rather than 2022. But only the international community, through its efforts, will be able to stop the war because Russia is 24 times bigger than Ukraine by size. The Russian armed forces are also much more numerous, so we need the support of the whole world.
Также намного многочисленны, поэтому мы нуждаемся в поддержке всего мира.
And what about the countries like China and Israel that have sought to, you know, mediate between the two parties, that have retained good relations with Russia? And in China's case, I mean, Israel's providing some humanitarian aid, but China's actively considering providing military assistance to Russia. How are people feeling about also the United Arab Emirates, right? These countries that have really emphasized a neutral position. Is there anger directed to these countries? How are people feeling about this?
In fact, yes, the situation with China sufficiently scares Ukraine. And we understand that China is playing a dual game and possibly wants to win from this war and receive some of its preferences. But at this stage, it seems difficult to predict how events will develop further within the context of China. I would also like to add that in 2014, when Russia occupied Crimea and a part of the Donbass, Western countries also introduced similar policies, especially Germany, as they continued to trade with Russia and act as if nothing had happened. And now we see the cost of these Western policies in relation to Russia. When Putin saw that he got away with the occupation of Crimea in 2014, he continued his imperial politics of conquest.
Имперскую захватническую политику.
All right. You've been very generous with your time, and I really appreciate your taking the time to talk to me. Thank you so much for doing this.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Kara Schillen of Goat Rodeo. Hey folks, have you yet become a material supporter of Lawfare? You can do so at our Patreon, patreon.com/lawfare. The Lawfare Podcast is edited by Jen Patia Howell. Our music is, as always, performed by the one, the only, Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.